Hey, it's Tony Bruschi from Dark Side of Wikipedia. After a year of doing this show and you guys loving it, we've created a way to give you even more Dark Side content. How? By you becoming a Dark Sider. That's a supporter of the Dark Side of Wikipedia. When you become a Dark Sider, you get advanced access to our episodes months before they're released to the public. So if you want more to binge away on, this is the way to get it. In addition to the advanced episodes, you also get our archive of episodes, and all of it is commercial free. So if you like the show and you want to listen without the pesky commercials, become a Dark Sider. In addition to all of that, we're also now giving final chapters to all of our new episodes. That means you get to hear an extra chapter of the story and discussion, usually an extra 15, 20, 25 minutes of content for each episode that we're calling the final chapter, which is exclusively for Dark Sider members. The reality is, this show is not free for us to create. It takes a lot of time, effort, and money to put it together. So if you'd like to be part of the Dark Side of Wikipedia, support us and keep us on the air, and in exchange, get all of those extras, please become a Dark Sider. Do it by signing up at patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia, or go to our website, darksideofwiki.com, and click Become a Dark Sider. It's only $5 a month, and you get access to everything I just talked about. Check it out today, patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia, or go to our website, darksideofwiki.com, and click Become a Darksider, and help keep Dark Side of Wikipedia alive. He did not fit the profile of a serial killer. Somehow, how could he be one? That's the question everyone was asking as they tried to connect the dots. The dots involving the brutal slayings of more than 10 women in Southern California. How did they find the killer? And how did they determine that they had the right man? Today, the story of the grim sleeper, Lonnie David Franklin Jr., on the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
An elusive serial killer linked to 10 slayings in South Los Angeles and Inglewood over nearly two decades resurfaced in 2008 to kill again. Los Angeles police officials said long stretches of time between known killings and a disjointed, often dormant investigation that spanned different generations of detectives left police unclear for years that a single man was behind the slayings. The latest slaying was tied conclusively to the others by DNA analysis in May of 2007. The day those tests came in, we realized we had a serial killer on our hands who'd been active for 23 years, said LAPD Detective Dennis Kilcone, who heads the task force of seven detectives charged with solving the killings. Except for one man, the killer has targeted young black women. He sexually abused the women, detectives said, and left almost all of their bodies in a corridor along Western Avenue in South Los Angeles, often in alleys. Detectives suspect that most of the women were working as prostitutes at the time that they were killed. Kilcone and his team have been working quietly, trying to breathe life into the investigation without tipping off the killer. They've retracted cold leads and are collaborating with state officials on an exhaustive search of prison records. Detectives have begun examining nearly three dozen other cases that bear similarities in serial killer slayings. The latest killing was reported this week by the LA Weekly. For more than two decades before that, however, the killer slipped on and off the LAPD's radar. The first known slaying occurred in the summer of 1985, when 29-year-old Deborah Jackson was shot three times in the chest, police said. Her body was left in an alley near West Gage Avenue. It was a particularly dark period for the city, when widespread cocaine use, rampant crime, and vicious killings were rife in South LA. 3 years passed before police realized that something larger was occurring, when ballistics tests showed that the same handgun used to kill Jackson had been used in seven other killings. Detectives handling the investigation were troubled In late 1988, the killer shot a woman in the chest with the same gun, sexually assaulted her, and left her for dead. She survived, giving police their first, albeit vague, description of a man as an African-American in his mid-30s. She also described his car as orange Ford Pinto. The new information led detectives to pull registration records on every Pinto in Los Angeles County, said the sergeant, but the search led nowhere. Then the trail went cold. For about 13 years, no new deaths were linked to the killer. Everything just dried up. They ran out of clues. They got onto other things, Kilcone said of the detectives working the case. The case has gotten moved further and further back on the shelf. The killer had been all but forgotten until a few years ago when recently developed DNA analysis technology made it clear he was still at large and still killing. In 2001, LAPD detectives under the direction of Police Chief Bernard C. Parks began delving into thousands of unsolved cases that had built up over the years. In 2004, Detective Cliff Shepard was poring over old murder cases from South LA and found a preserved DNA sample that was taken from the body of one of the killer's earlier victims. Analysis of the DNA showed that it showed conclusive similarities to samples found on the body of a 35-year-old woman killed in 2003 and on 14-year-old Princess Berthamu, who was found strangled and beaten in an Inglewood alley in March of 2002. All of a sudden, we had two more, Kilcone said. But again, the case has faded, with detectives no closer to finding the killer. And again, he seemed to disappear with no more killings tied to him. In 2006, an Inglewood detective made headlines when he traveled to Fresno and to a prison to get a DNA sample from a 65-year-old white inmate who had made incriminating statements about killing prostitutes in L.A. to law enforcement officials. But tests showed he was not the killer. Then on the first day of 2007, a homeless man found the body of Jayensa Peters, 25, on Southwestern Avenue. She'd been shot and covered with a garbage bag. When DNA tests linked her killer to the earlier slayings, Police Chief William J. Bratton ordered Kilcone to launch the task force. Investigators checked the killer's DNA against a federal DNA database of known criminals, but again found no matches. One popular theory among detectives, Kilcone said, was that the killer was in prison during the two distinct periods when no killings were connected to him. Following that lead, investigators of the California Department of Corrections have been working with the LAPD task force to sort through a list of about 50,000 inmates from Los Angeles County who were convicted of violent crimes during one of those periods and do not have DNA samples on record. The two agencies are filtering the lists in search of men who were in prison during both periods of the killer's apparent inactivity. But Kilcone said the killer may have just avoided detection and committed crimes that have not been connected to him. It cannot be so arrogant to think that everything this guy has ever done came with an LAPD crime report attached to it, he said. The task force has identified 33 old LAPD cases that have similarities to the killings and have begun the painstaking process of reviewing them. Task force members also automatically receive alerts when other LAPD detectives or uninformed cops report a homicide involving females found outdoors. They visited more than 15 crime scenes, but none have had the marks of the suspect they're looking for. One promising route the LAPD has not yet been able to try is comparing the serial killer's DNA with samples in the criminal database in search of his close relatives. The familial searches can be done, but only with permission of Attorney General Jerry Brown. The technique is controversial, with critics calling it an invasion of privacy. Spokesperson for Brown declined to comment on whether or when Brown would approve a familial search on the case. LAPD Deputy Chief Charlie Beck, meanwhile, said the department would love to pursue it if it becomes available. And that's where we start today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. That would be the article, one of the articles that was written very close to the time of them starting to determine who Lonnie David Franklin Jr. is and his connection to that spree of insanity that went on for many, many years. It's Tony and Sean with you on today's episode of the program. Thoughts thus far on old Lonnie?
So, to make sure we're on the same page here, there was a 13-year stretch where nothing occurred, and then they were gonna link a murder that did happen back to 13 years ago?
Yeah, because he did a lot of these crimes in the 80s, and then in the early 2000s, he popped back up onto the radar because of the DNA evidence. So they found the same DNA on crimes that were committed around 08 as the same DNA that was on the very similar crimes that were committed in like 88 or something like that. And so, they realized this is the same guy, but they didn't know who he was at that point.
So what are you doing for 13 years? I mean, do you get, obviously you have found a new hobby that has kept you busy for 2, 6, 7, 8 years.
Model trains.
What makes you wake up one day 13 years later and say, you know what? That itch needs to be scratched again.
I don't know. I don't know what that is. Is it something with some people where they commit a crime? Because the problem with criminals is the fact that they think they can keep repeating and getting away with it over and over and over. But most of them do it somewhat frequently, where it's like, I got away with that. I'm going to try that again. They keep going and going and going, whether it be murder, whether it be financial crimes, whether it be whatever it is. It's very rare that somebody has the, I guess, lack of impulsivity or control to say, you know what, I'm good. Got my killing in. I'm going to go work at Denny's, you know, as a prep cook or something. And then they're just good. So I don't know what he did for 13 years. We'll probably get into that here and figure that out. But that's the weird thing about this is did he just sit there and, you know, move on with his life? I don't know. I mean, how do you move on with your life? I mean, number one, how do you commit these crimes to begin with? But then let's say you do commit those crimes and somehow you realize that was wrong. Shouldn't have done that. Do you turn yourself in and do that and take what justice will give you? Or do you at that point say that was wrong and I'm going to hope to God I never get caught?
Just is so interesting to do something so heinous as killing multiple people and then to have such a long stretch where you don't and then you get back into it. But I would imagine that just adds to the list of certain things that we just do not, we're not able to comprehend within our brain of someone that would not only do that once, but do it multiple times and taking another person's life.
Well, and the thing is, when they're in prison, you'll sometimes hear the stories of, oh, they realized they were wrong and now they found God or whatever they found. And they're so horribly sorry and they just want to do something good with their life. And now they're counseling other prisoners or doing this or that. And they're, you know, they realize they're in there for the rest of their lives and they're not trying to get out, but they've accepted their guilt. I guess someone could do that on the outside if they were never caught and then try and turn their life around. But are you really turning your life around if you never admit your guilt to those crimes with those people, those families that have a loved one who's dead and no one knows who the hell did it? Can you ever really turn your life around there and do good, quote unquote, or make anything of yourself? Or are you obligated at that point to say, I did this shit? Come give me the consequences.
I think that is to the person that makes a decision. Quite honestly, I think if you want to truly make your life better and turn it around, you can. Mm-hmm. You'll just bury whatever that guilt or whatever it is, you'll bury it away and it will never come up and you can live the rest of your life. I would then think that there are certain people who try and ultimately do turn themselves in. But I absolutely think someone can kill someone. The family and their loved ones will never, ever find out who did it. And you can go on his life and be a successful insurance person, real estate agent, car detailer. I mean, I'm half joking. Sure. It's very sad that you would like to think that you can, that you or me could kill someone when we're, I don't know, 20. Mm-hmm. And then 22 years old, wake up one day and say, you know what? It's just, we're going to take that mental thoughts, we're going to put them in a shoebox, we're going to bury them like I did the body, and we're good, we're done. And then fast forward and live the rest of your life.
I think that that area is where I just, my mind doesn't work that way, because I am such a person who feels guilt for shit I don't even do. You know, it's like I will feel guilty about stuff that I had absolutely nothing to do with. I've always been that way. When we were kids and someone would be like, who did this? Even though I had nothing to do with things, I'd be the one that would be looked at. Like, Tony, your face is turning red. I'm like, I didn't do it. And if I did do something, I feel the guilt for like ever. I have a funny story. In fact, the other day, Harper and me, my daughter, we went to a playground. And she ran into a friend of hers that she had gone to school with in a different school district. And she was so happy to see an old friend. And she's asking me, Daddy, have you ever done that where it's a totally different place in a different area and you're running into an old friend again? And I said, you know, funny story, kind of, yes. And here's the guilt story of it. When I was in about third grade, number one, I never got into fights. I really never got into trouble. But there's one time I was on the playground. I remember jumping off of the playset when the bell rang, and I didn't look where I was jumping, and I accidentally, my foot like hit the back hip of a girl who was bending down to pick up a bouncy ball, and she started crying because it hurt. And I felt so guilty and so bad because I never would do that to anybody, but I did it on accident. I didn't know what to do. I just ran away and I got in line and nobody knew who did it. And I remember everybody at like, who did that? Who made her cry? You know, and I got away with it. I really did. But I remembered this damn thing until I was about 19. And you and me were working at a station in central Wisconsin.
You never told the girl?
Never told the girl.
What a dick.
I know, total asshole for a third grader. She was a grade ahead of me, but I knew who she was because she had a brother who was like a grade behind me. So I knew who she was. But again, I mean, we, you know, life went on. Anyway, never told her. I don't think she was traumatized. I was the one who remembered this.
I saw her on Maury a couple years ago.
You saw her at our radio.
This anonymous third grader accidentally half grazed my hip with his foot. That's what made me start to boil crack and start a meth lab in my two-bedroom apartment.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if that was. No, I'm kidding. But so we had a part-timer up at that station that this is where I met you, actually. And she came
in. I was dating this girl.
No. Remember our part-timer named Heidi? That worked there for a little while. Okay.
She was like the receptionist, utility, whatever.
Yeah. It was her friend. She came in. She's like showing her the station one day. She's like, hey, Tony, meet my friend. And I think the girl's name was Laura. And she goes, my friend Laura. And she's actually from the town you grew up in, which is, you know, 4 hours away. And I look at her. I'm like, did you go to this school? She's like, yeah. I'm like, is your last name so-and-so? She's like, yeah. I'm like, holy shit. It's the girl. And I said, this is going to sound completely insane, but in third grade, I did this. And I guess I still feel guilty, but you're seeing you brought back that memory. And I remember feeling so guilty about it that year. And I never told you or anybody. She's like, I have no recollection of this. I'm like, thank God.
Thank you for making it super fucking weird.
Exactly.
Okay, we're going to walk along now.
Exactly. But that's my guilt. So I feel guilty about that sort of thing. I cannot comprehend how you fucking kill people and can just like move on with life. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how that would work. Anyway, that's my story of guilt. Let's continue on. This is the Wikipedia entry about the Grim Sleeper. We'll learn more about his line of depravity. The Grim Sleeper is a nickname for convicted serial killer Lonnie David Franklin Jr., responsible for at least 10 murders and one attempted murder in Los Angeles, California. The attacker was dubbed the Grim Sleeper because he appeared to have taken a 14-year break from his crimes from 1988 to 2002. In July 2010, Franklin was arrested as a suspect, and after many delays, his trial began in February of 2016. On May 5th, 2016, the jury convicted him of killing 9 women and 1 teenage girl. On June 6th, 2016, the jury recommended the death sentence, and on August 10th, 2016, Los Angeles Superior Court sentenced him to death for each of the 10 victims named in the verdict. Franklin was born on August 30th, 1952. He grew up in South Central Los Angeles, married, had two children. He was given a general discharge from the United States Army on July 24, 1975. After police discovered several dead women in alleyways and dumpsters in South Los Angeles, California during the mid-1980s, Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department and police began investigating the murders, setting up the Southside Slayer Task Force. At the time, the police thought that the murders were committed by one person labeled the Southside Slayer. These crimes were announced to the public on September 23, 1985. Eventually, the LAPD and the sheriff's detectives realized that several serial killers were murdering women, and it was a difficult task for the detectives to decide which murders were linked. Amongst other murders, Lewis Crane, Daniel Lee Seibert committed at least two of the murders each, and Ivan Hill and Michael Hughes at least one each. A separate series of killings committed with the murder of Deborah Jackson with a different MO involving a firearm. These became known misleadingly as the Strawberry Murders. Two decades later, the perpetrator of these crimes was named Grim Sleeper due to a long period of apparent inactivity between crimes. In May 2007, the murder of Jansa Peters, 25, was linked through DNA analysis to 11, possibly 12, unsolved murders in Los Angeles, the first of which occurred in 1985. The 800 Task Force was informed, consisting of seven detectives. After a four-month investigation, the LA Weekly investigative reporter Christine Pelisk broke the news of the secret 800 Task Force, the linking of Peter's killings to a string of murders going back 23 years, and the fact that Mayor Anito Villagrosa and Police Chief William Bratton had been silent on the killer's existence. The mayor and chief never issued a press release nor warned the South Los Angeles community of the killer's continuing activities. In some cases, the alternative newspaper was the first to inform the families that their daughters had long been confirmed as victims of a serial killer. In March 2009, Christine Pelisk of the LA Weekly did an extensive interview with Anita Washington, the sole survivor of the Grim Sleeper's attacks. She described him as a black man in his early 30s. He looked neat, tidy, kind of geeky. He wore a black polo shirt tucked into khaki trousers. She also described him as a thin, neat, polite, and well-groomed African-American guy. He owned an orange Ford Pinto with a white racing stripe on the hood. It looked like a Hot Wheels toy car, the survivor recalled. He offered her a ride. After she refused, he told me that that is what is wrong with you black women. You think you are all that, unquote. He was persistent. After some banter back and forth, she got into his car. She, begin quote, was impressed by the car's interior. The gear shift handle was memorable, pimped out with a ping-pong-sized marble ball. The inside was all white with white diamond pattern upholstery. When she mentioned a party, he definitely invited himself, and she said he was welcome to come. He then said that he needed to stop briefly at his uncle's house. They wound through residential roads in his sporty car, ending up on the street whose name she did not take note of. The polite stranger parked outside a mustard-colored house, partly obscured by hedges, got out, walked up to the house, briefly talked to someone inside, and returned about 10 minutes later. They began arguing when he suddenly pulled a small handgun out of his pocket on the driver's side of the Pinto and shot her in the chest as he drove along the residential streets. The killer apparently documented his attacks with a Polaroid camera. She blacked out but was startled awake by the bright flash of the camera. The man had taken her picture and sexually assaulted her. She remembers grabbing him. The two struggled. She pleaded to be taken to a hospital. He refused. Despite her half-conscious condition, she's almost certain he told her he couldn't take her to a hospital because he didn't want to get caught. In late August 2008, the same week, The Weekly broke the sole survivor's story with information on the Grim Sleeper's body count of 13 victims. An aide to Police Chief William Bratton said he was too busy to comment on the case. In early September, 08, officials in Los Angeles announced that they were offering a $500,000 reward to help catch the killer who's murdered at least 10 women and a man in two sprees over the past 20 years. On November 1, 2008, a story about the Grim Sleeper appeared on the television program America's Most Wanted. The program stated that the killer was most likely a black male but did not want to rule anyone out. On February 25, 2009, for the first time, Chief Bratton held a press conference regarding the case, at which formally gave the killer the name Grim Sleeper. chosen by LA Weekly. Bratton then released a call from the 1980s, made a 911 operator, in which a man reported having seen a body, which later turned out to be a victim of the Grim Sleeper, getting dumped by the killer, with a detailed description and license plate number of a van connected with a now-closed Cosmopolitan Church. In December 2009, the LAPD re-released the original police sketch of the Grim Sleeper based on the description given to them in 1988 by his only known survivor, Anrita Washington. The sketch shows a black male with pockmarks across both cheeks. In December of 2009, the LAPD also released three age-enhanced composite drawings showing the markedly different faces of three middle-aged black males. Then on July 7, 2010, the Los Angeles Times reports that an arrest had been made. District Attorney Steve Cooley identified the suspect as 57-year-old Lonnie David Franklin Jr., a mechanic who worked between 1981 and 89 for the City of Los Angeles in the Sanitation Department and briefly for the Police Department. The arrest of Franklin reportedly was due, at least in part, to the use of familial DNA analysis. Police had been unable to find an exact match between DNA found at the crime scenes associated with the Grim Sleeper and any of the profiles in California's DNA profile database. Thus, police searched the database to try to find stored profiles that demonstrated sufficient similarity to the profile from the crime scene evidence to allow police to infer a familial relationship between the person who left the DNA at the crime scenes and the similar profile stored in the database. Police eventually located similar DNA belonging to Franklin's son, Christopher, who had been convicted of a felony weapons charge, according to Los Angeles District Attorney Steve Cooley. Detectives then used a piece of discarded pizza with Franklin's DNA to make the link. Once Los Angeles undercover police officer pretended to be a waiter at a restaurant where the suspect ate, he collected dishes, silverware, glasses, and pizza crusts to obtain DNA. The identification was used to arrest Franklin after his DNA was obtained and deemed a match. Saliva found on the victim's breasts was used to obtain a DNA match, thus linking Franklin to the murders. Law enforcement missed an opportunity to catch Franklin because his DNA was never collected. In 2003, he was convicted of a felony and was serving 3 years of supervised probation. When he was on probation, his DNA was supposed to be entered in the database. In 2004, voters approved the Proposition 69. The law states that DNA must be collected for all people charged with a crime. It also requires the expansion of the DNA database. Authorities collected and sorted through thousands of DNA samples. On July of 2005, Franklin was on unsupervised probation. During that time, Franklin's DNA never entered into the system. Probation officers do not collect DNA samples from people that are on unsupervised probation between the periods of November 2004 and August 2005. During that period, the probation department also did not have the resources to immediately collect samples. Officers do not collect samples until August 2005. Franklin has a criminal record dating back to 1989. He was convicted of two charges of stolen property, one charge of misdemeanor assault, and one charge of battery. He served time for one of the charges of stolen property. He's charged with 10 homicides and one attempted murder. He's held without bail and could face the death penalty if convicted. He's not charged in the death of an 11th suspected victim, an African-American man. There's no DNA evidence in that case. On December 16, 2010, the Los Angeles Police Department released 180 photos of women found in Franklin's home. Police officials released the images after unsuccessful attempts to identify the individuals, possibly additional victims. These people are not suspects. We don't even know if they are victims, but we do know this. Lonnie Franklin's reign of terror in the city of Los Angeles, which spanned well over two decades, culminating with almost a dozen murder victims, certainly needs to be investigated further, said Chief Charlie Beck of the LAPD. In all, investigators found over 1,000 photos in several hundred hours of video in the home. The images show mainly African-American women of wide age range, from teenagers to middle-aged and older, often nude. Police believe Franklin took many of the pictures, which show both conscious and unconscious individuals and date back up to 30 years. The photos were released in an effort to identify the women with the help of citizens. On November 3, 2011, Reuters reported that the police were considering Lonnie David Franklin as a suspect in six more slayings of additional female victims. The police were investigating two of the six as potential victims killed during a 14-year lapse between the initial spat of grim sleeper murders that ended in 1988 and several more that began in 2002. Of the remaining four victims, two bodies were discovered in the 1980s and two were reported missing in 2005. But the remains of the other two were never found, police said. Detectives said they linked Franklin to the six additional killings after reviewing hundreds of old case files and seeking the public's help in identifying a collection of 180 photographs of women and girls that were found in his possession. On May 5th, 2016, after nearly 3 months of trial and a day and a half of jury deliberation, Lonnie David Franklin was convicted of 10 counts of murder and one count of attempted murder. On June 6, 2016, a Los Angeles County jury sentenced the serial killer to death, closing an important legal chapter in the grisly slayings that terrorized South LA for more than two decades. So there you go, a lovely guy that finally got caught.
So next time you're hankering for a nice slice of pie, watch yourself. You better eat all of it. Eat all of it or be very skeptical of where you trash it.
I wonder, has anyone gotten a... Because the way that they're doing the familial DNA is essentially through services like 23andMe and Ancestry, and there's a whole slew of them out there, where, you know, you submit your DNA and then they'll give you whatever history exists on record about where you're from. And as more people do that, the more information there's going to be. How many people got one of those 23andMe or Ancestry kits for their birthday or for Christmas or whatever, and they go, I'd like to do this, but I'm kind of concerned that if I turn this in, Uncle Larry over there is going to get convicted of murdering people. Because, and he's just so peaceful now. He doesn't do anything. But I've always suspected he might be the so-and-so killer in my town. You think that ever happens where like a family's like, I'm a little hesitant about this because I don't know if, you know, maybe we're going to find out more than we want to know.
Is there something you're wanting to share with us, Tony?
No, actually, I don't suspect any of my family members as being serial killers. I got some weird ones, but I don't have any that I suspect of being killers, quite honestly.
I would suspect, I would think. I guess that's the roll of the dice there. When you want to find out information that you don't possess, you may find out some information you don't know.
Because you submit that. And then that's in the database. And then if they're searching for somebody, I mean, then and they're in the database, that could connect some dots there. That would just be a really interesting plot for a movie or something, like big family Christmas, everybody's together. And then one person bought everybody like the DNA kits.
Hey. Why is a SWAT truck outside?
And there's that one person in the corner going, oh, thanks. And they just like kind of like toss it in the garbage. They're not going
to. Thanks, Danielle. Fuck. Now I have to go to jail. I was supposed to pick up the cherry cheesecake that I was going to bring to tomorrow's Christmas Day gathering because we spend Christmas Eve with this side of the family. Fuck. Now I'm getting arrested.
Have a holly jolly Christmas. Yeah, I think that would be interesting. I actually have a one of the DNA kits that I got for Christmas. I've not done yet. Not for this reason. I just haven't done it yet. But I do want to do it just to, you know, learn or see what they tell me. Not that I'm suspecting I'm going to find out a serial killer anywhere. But wouldn't that be exciting?
It's the gift that keeps on giving year round.
It is. We're going to go in our final chapter into the Grim Sleeper sentencing. And read an article from the LA Times and dive into that. If you want to hear the final chapter of this story and how it all ends for good old Lonnie, then become a Dark Sider. You do that by signing up at patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia. Go to our website, darksideofwiki.com, and click Become a Dark Sider. With that, you'll get access to all of our final chapters, get access to our advanced episodes months before they're released to the public. You can start binging away in them there, and they're all commercial free. $5 a month keeps us on the air, and you get all the extras. Again, patreon.com /darkside of Wikipedia. Sean and myself will see you there.